Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to IDVAC Blog Talk Radio, brought to you by the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community, in collaboration with the Women of Color Network and the African American Domestic Peace Project. IDVAC Blog Talk Radio is made possible by a grant from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Administration for Children and Families, Family and Youth Services Bureau, and Family Violence Prevention and Services Program. Now, points of view expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the official positions or policies of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. IDVAC Blog Talk Radio brings you rich conversations and education on issues surrounding domestic violence in African American and African communities.
And welcome tonight. Welcome to IDVAC Blog Talk Radio Show.
Thank you, sir. Okay, thank you.
I'm trying to make sure that we're all on the air together. I believe that we are. Once again, welcome to IDVAC Blog Talk Radio Show. This is your co-host tonight. This is Reverend J.R. Thicklin, along with our co-host, Dr. Annette Douglas. And we're coming from the African American Domestic Peace Project out of West Palm Beach, Florida. And tonight we're very excited because we have a very interesting broadcast on tonight, one that I think that you'll find both enlightening and one that you will find quite a bit of information here. Of course, with this being also National Domestic Violence Awareness Month, this show here falls right in line with so much. And so with that being said, I want to bring on our co-host, Dr. Annette Douglas, and she's going to tell you a little bit more about not only our show tonight entitled Tapping the Power Within, but also going to have the opportunity to introduce our very special guest that's with us on tonight. So Dr. Douglas, if you're there in the other studio, please introduce yourself and tell the people what they're in store for tonight.
Well, good evening. I hope that we'll have a good attendance tonight because we do have a very special show, and I'm excited to be here. I was reading the book that is written by the lady that we're having on the show. Her book is Scared Silence, and it's by Mildred Muhammad. She's going to be on our show tonight, and we're also having Chief Michael Blow, retired from the Maryland Police Department, who was very much involved with the investigation and the final capture of the sniper, John Muhammad, who was once married to Mildred Muhammad. What I've learned when I heard Mildred speak before and when I read her book is that a lot of the violence that John carried with him across the country, around the country, stemmed from domestic violence. And she was thoroughly involved with that. So we've asked her to please come on this particular radio show and share with us what happened, what was going on, and because it's such a dynamic. We've heard many stories. Some of us have lived different stories. But I remember listening to her speak, and she brought everything in, and what I thought was power. At some point along the way, she reached down in her gut and pulled every power out that she could to take control of her situation and control of her for her children's sake. And Mike, Chief Michael Blow, he did the same. He was superficially using a lot of papers, you know, do step one before you do step three, etc. But then he reached down within himself and he said, enough is enough. We're going to have to take this investigation in a different way to end this situation, to end this particular violence. And there are so many listeners out there tonight who are going through something similar. How to reach down, how to say enough is enough, and to stop the intergenerational movements that are happening, for instance, with our children experiencing this violence in their home. That a lot has happened in the news lately. We heard about the two boys who were in Georgia who attempted to kill their parents. we heard about the young man of non-color, the white man in the church in South Carolina that killed a lot of people. Then we look back at his history. He's stemming from a same similar situation of domestic violence and how it comes out into the real light of the world. I watched last week a show where President Obama, our first sitting president, to visit a federal penal institution and talk to a number of people there, people who were arrested on first offense for a crime that did not warrant the penalty that they received. But at the same time, how did they get there? Where did they come from? So J.R. Ficklin and I are here tonight to talk about that, to bring these two people on, and for you to participate. Mildred, I want you to even speak about the YWCA. I don't want to give your story away, but I want you to know that there are members on tonight from the YWCA who are urgently listening to hear what it is that you can portray upon them. So, J.R., let's bring our guest on. Let me also say that Chief Michael Blow, not only has he been attributed in that particular instance, but he was actually on CNN talking to Anderson Cooper, and he spoke about some of this investigation, and he also has been a contributing consultant to the Ferguson movement that's been going on in the Missouri area, as well as the gray movement, what was going on, Black Lives Matter, happening in Baltimore. So we're going to bring all of that, tie it all in together tonight. JR, if you will.
Okay, I believe that Mildred is there, and I know Fatima is actually manning the board. So without further ado, Mildred Muhammad, my dear friend, domestic violence expert, have traveled the country and internationally with her story. Mildred, welcome to ITVAC Blog Talk Radio tonight.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate being given the opportunity to be with you tonight.
Well, as Dr. Douglas have said, and many of us have heard your story, but I think the more we hear it, and there are so many that know of the story of the D.C. sniper but don't know of the thing that actually precipitated that was behind it, and there's just so much there. And Dr. Douglas, when we were all in our planning stage about this particular show here, one of the things that was very much laid on our heart was talking about tapping the power within, because she recognized the incredible strength and courage. I mean, you know, it's not like you had time to sit back and think about, let's see what I'm going to do. You had to think in real time. You know, you had to deal with every situation as it was happening. And so when she came up with the topic of tapping the power within, the first thing she said to me, you think that we could get Mildred to be on the program because you are the epitome of one who tapped the power within. Mm-hmm. And so with that being said, Dr. D, I know that you had a lot of things that you wanted, and you could tell Mildred exactly what, you know, some of the things that you were talking about that you was hoping that she would be able to share.
Yes, I do. I remember that you spoke about how you were in Maryland and you were almost just waiting to get your children. I'd like for you to tell the audience about when you first met him, like most of us, when we first meet the man of our love, you know, he's a person that sits on high and we have so much trust in him. And then you learned on that there wasn't a lot of trust that you could continue to have in him. And so I want you to tell us what was happening, I believe you were in Seattle, Washington, that led him to decide that he was going to participate in the abuse to you and your family.
Wait, that he was going to participate in what? I'm sorry,
in abuse to you and your children. What led that? What brought that on? And then how were you able to take it to a point where you said enough is enough? And then at that point, he actually just escaped and left you barren without your children. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, ma'am. At that point, John was out of the military, and we had started our own business repairing cars. It was an express car truck mechanic. It was a mobile auto repair service, but he had been having multiple affairs with the customers, and so I asked him for a divorce. And he didn't want one. I told him that he was acting free, that he may as well be free, and that he needed to leave the home. So he left, but he still had a key to the house. And he would come in the middle of the night, walk around the bed to listen to hear if I was breathing, and then leave out of the house again. I had the locks changed so that he couldn't do that anymore, but then he had the phone number changed, and that was a back-and-forth issue. And finally, I went to court, and the judge gave me a lifetime restraining order. But at that time, John had already told me that you have become my enemy, and as my enemy, I will kill you. The court decided that we needed to have a visitation plan.
Mm-hmm.
And we had someone to come over to pick up the children and take them to John and then bring them back to me. The first weekend went fine. However, the second weekend was my mother's birthday. He was supposed to bring them back. He did not bring them back. And that led to an 18-month period of when I didn't see or hear from my children. So I moved to Maryland because my sister called me when I was living in a shelter that she was sick and she needed help. While here, I called the FBI. The FBI came and took my paperwork, said that they would do the investigation because I told them that my children were no longer in the country. Once they reviewed my paperwork, he sent it back to me, told me that there was nothing they could do, and instructed me to call the Seattle office since that's where their case originated. I called the FBI office. However, they decided that they wanted to put me in the middle of a parking lot and use me as a decoy. That way they could lure John out. And I told them that, excuse me, it's going to be a headshot and you're not going to know where the bullet is coming from. But their excuse was they was just trying to help me out. Once the executive director of the shelter that I was living in called and told me that they may have found my children, I had to fly back to Tacoma in order to have an emergency custody hearing. The YWCA gave me an attorney. Her name was Angela, and an advocate by the name of Heather. They escorted me to the courthouse where we were able to get the children, because John had to sign, release them to me, did all of my paperwork pro se, and since my paperwork was in perfect order, then they gave them back to me. Once we got the children, we flew back to Maryland. A year later is when the shooting started. It was John's friend, Robert Holmes, who called the FBI and said, I don't know anything about your case, but you may want to look at John Allen Muhammad. His ex-wife is in the area, and he may be there to hurt her. And to my understanding, that's when the investigation changed, and they ultimately caught John, and that was that.
Well, I remember that I happened to be living in the area at that time, so I was amidst all of the tragedy that was going on, and at the school where the young boy was shot was right there in my neighborhood, and also in the neighborhood of Police Chief Michael Blow, who was a part of the investigation. Now, I know that it takes a lot of a lot of power within all of us to get by, and that many of us walk around feeling powerless. And I'm sure from what I hear in your story and from what I read in your book that there was some point that you felt powerless. But most indicative to the listening, and that is that what Ms. Muhammad went through, she turned to support, and she went to the shelter. She went to the YWCA. She went to the different investigators, and, you know, sometimes you get that no or that door shut in your face, but there were those who did not shut the door in her face, and that was a piece of power that she reached within. But, Keith Lowe, can you tell us a little bit of when the situation came to the Maryland police to their attention? Was it, did it happen when the shootings began in Maryland, or did it happen when you heard that the shootings are coming from across the country?
Well, I can tell you the investigation. And first off, thank you for having me. And just one quick point of clarification. My interactions with the CNN folk was regarding school violence. I would love to take credit for that, but I can't do it. So, but anyway, of course, the sniper, the whole sniper thing came to our attention once Montgomery County had the initial shootings. They had several shootings in one day, and that sort of brought this whole thing to light. And then, of course, once they began looking into it and looking at the ballistics and a lot of other things, they quickly realized that they were dealing with the same person that was committing these horrible acts. And, of course, as we all know, it turned out to be Mr. Muhammad in the long run. And so I can tell you, you're absolutely right. Once the community, not only the law enforcement community, but once the Washington, Virginia, Maryland community realized what was going on, it was a very frightening time. And I'm sure you all remember folks were afraid to get gasoline. They had to cancel schools and activities and so forth. So this situation really had a profound impact on the D.C. area. So that's really when it really bubbled to the surface in terms of, hey, we've got something very serious going on here.
Wow. Now, callers, you have the opportunity to push the number one on your phone if you have any questions or if you wish to join into this discussion. We welcome you to do that. We'd like to hear from you out there of how this may be something similar happening to you. And if you have any questions for any of us, for our guests who can help you to answer something you thought about, you don't have to give your name. You can just push the button number one, and we'll call you in. The engineer will open the line to you. But we know that when that was called in with you, Chief Flo, and this investigation began, I guess it took a multitude of people, not just the police department, but can you say that there were even the schools that were involved, and how were they involved, the churches, and were they involved, how were they involved, and did you go out and speak to the community? Because here's a person who, in a car shooting, like shots coming from nowhere, no one knowing. And like Ms. Muhammad has said, you won't know where that shot is coming from. You know, how was that reaction there in the Maryland state?
Well, I can tell you there was the level of concern was just unprecedented. Because, for example, you had it began, I believe, on October the 2nd. You had a man that was shot in Wheaton, Maryland. And then on the 3rd, they had five shootings in the same day. I believe there was one in D.C. and four in Maryland. And so as soon as all that started happening, law enforcement realized we've got something serious going on here. And then once the media began reporting information, the community concern, as it should have been, was heightened. And as the month of October moved forward, there was a lot of information going back and forth between the various law enforcement agencies. And again, you have to understand, it was unparalleled law enforcement involvement. You had the majority of the law enforcement agencies stretching from Baltimore City all the way down to Stafford County, Virginia. You had the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You just had a large number, and of course, Montgomery County. A lot of agencies were trying to coordinate to find out exactly how quickly we could get a hold of this person. And so you asked about community concern. There was absolutely a lot of concern. People were afraid to send their children to school. They didn't want them standing on the bus corners. I know at my daughter's school, we had several off-duty officers whose children attended my daughter's school along with my daughter. And we were out there in the mornings, and the children were literally getting out of the cars and running into school. And so and that was happening throughout the region. And as you remember, even the after-school events, the soccer games or football games, were being canceled because no one wanted to take the risk of being a target. And unfortunately, you even remember a 13-year-old boy was wounded in Bowie, who was a student, on his way to school one morning. And so this created a great deal of concern. I know law enforcement agencies, all the ones up and down the Maryland, Virginia, D.C. area, were in constant contact with their community members, those that felt comfortable coming out in the evening. They were coming out to meetings where they were being provided with information. The media was providing information. And so I think the media was actually the greatest source of information because people were uncomfortable even coming out to get gasoline to go to work. And so there was a lot of information coming from the media that was coming from law enforcement. So it was an unprecedented time in the Maryland, D.C., Virginia area for coordination of resources, coordination of information. As you remember, just one example of law enforcement coordination, you remember initially the lookout was for a box truck, a white box truck, and that was posted on CNN and ABC and all the stations in Baltimore, Richmond, and all over the place. Well, I can't tell you how many white trucks were stopped in the month of October based on that information. And as of course, as it turned out, the actual vehicle was not a white box truck, but it was in fact a blue Chevy Caprice that was involved in that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, Ms. Muhammad, when I know a friend of yours, someone was able to call the police and alert them that John was in the area, but is that the first time that you heard that he was coming across country to come after you after all these years of marriage and the bearing of children and having a business together, and then he's going to suddenly come after you because he's angry? And was that the first time you heard that he was coming that direction, or did you know before he reached Maryland?
No, ma'am, I did not know before he reached Maryland. I didn't find out until October 23rd when ATF and the FBI knocked on my door.
Oh,
asked me when was the last time I had seen him, and I told them that it was September of 2001 at an emergency custody hearing in Tacoma, Washington. They asked had I heard about any shootings in any other place. I told them no. So they took me to the police station to further ask questions. And so they asked me again when was the last time I seen him. And I told them again, September 2001. They asked me to look at a letter to find out if I recognized the handwriting. It was the note that was posted to the tree. And I told them I did not recognize the handwriting. They asked me to listen to a CD to find out if I recognized the voice. The voice had an accent, and I told them I didn't know that either. The FBI agent, Jensen Jordan, stopped because he was walking in and out of the room on his cell phone, and that's when he said, "Miss Muhammad, we're just going to have to tell you, we're going to name your ex-husband as the sniper." That's when I found out. And then right after that is when he said, "Well, you were the target. He was killing innocent people to cover up your murder. And did I want to go into protective custody?" So they put me and my children and my sister and brother-in-law in protective custody that evening. And then on the 24th is when they caught him.
Boy, oh boy. That's a lot. That's a lot to have to go through and have your children right there and you having to protect them. You know, and you almost feel, like I said, feel powerless. And some people think of the word power as being in command and being in control. But it's actually an ability to produce an effect, you know, to make what we want to happen. And usually its presence is very unspoken. But part of the problem when we think of power, like I said, is command and control. But that's only one type of power, because we have to reach within our bodies, our souls, you know. And from a religious point of view, we need to have that as a part of our bearing in order to continue. Now, I'm very big on the impact of domestic abuse on our generations, on our intergenerations. And I know you had your children who don't want to hear that their father, their loved one, you know, is the abuser, is actually the person that could cause this type of strife. And they went through a lot. From the story, I remember that he had taken them to another country, and you mentioned 18 months. You didn't know where they were, or you knew they were in some place, but you didn't know how they were. And that when they were there, they were somewhat malnutritioned and not having the type of life that you would give them if they were with you. And then finally coming back, that's very traumatic, children. I mean, that's traumatic what they went through, and even traumatic in the home when children hover in the closet and or under the bed or under the covers because they're hearing their father, their loved one, abusing their other parent, their mother. You know, so and some of them have to reach down. I remember seeing that they reach down and call in the power within them to take control of this particular situation and call 911. But today, how are your children? They're adults now.
Right.
How are they? What happened to them?
Well, my children are fine. My son is 25. He's a top salesman at a retail store. My daughters just graduated out of college. My oldest daughter did, and my youngest daughter is still in college, but they both major in vocal performance, and they both sing classical music or opera in 8 different languages. So I had to go to the library and get a book on counseling and learn how to counsel them and myself because we couldn't find ethical counselors. It was a high-profile case, and everybody wanted to be on TV. So I had to take that into my own hands to make sure that my children were emotionally well and balanced as they grew older. I helped them to understand that, yes, this is what their dad did, and regardless of what anybody says or what he's done or how anyone feels, no one can change the fact that he's your dad, and no one can take away how you feel, and you have a right to feel whatever it is that you're feeling, and that is how we're going to get through this. We're going to get through this with the truth, and you can ask me whatever questions you want to. I will tell you the truth, even if it makes me look bad. And that's how we had to get through it, because a lot of people blamed me, and they wanted victim blaming in domestic violence is very, very high. And instead of asking the abuser, why do you abuse, you ask the victim, why do you stay? So the community said to me, well, if you would have stayed with him, then he just would have killed you. If you would have stayed on the West Coast, then the people on the East Coast would still be alive. How dare you call you and your children victims when none of you were killed or hurt? So my children never heard any of that until now. And they asked me just like a couple of months ago, why didn't you tell us that? I say, because you were too young. I was old enough to take that hit. I wasn't going to allow you to be emotionally hurt because people were saying insensitive things to you, about you and about us, and I just could not have you going through that. I was stronger to go through that than you.
You know, Mildred, you know, I had the opportunity to see the actual documentary show that was done. I think it was entitled Monster in My Family. And I thought it was a very powerful account. And one of the things that was very moving was actually not only the strength, the poise of your daughter. It was to me as if, you know, she had found her own voice in a way to share her experience and what she had come through. And I really commended that. When I watched the show, I was absolutely, you know, I guess I was taken by the fact of just seemingly the maturity that she had inside of it, as if she had come to her, you know, she had come to her own conclusion about things, and she definitely presented in a way that I think that people, they heard her side of, you know, what she felt and, you know, where she is now. So I really commend that, and the fact that you're saying that they're singing opera in 8 different languages. Oh God, I can't do opera in 1, but it's a testament of the fact of the resiliency also that they have.
Yes, that is so. But, you know, it takes, I think it takes the parent, because a lot of parents, a lot of mothers online tonight, and they hear you speaking, they're thinking the same thing. Well, wow, that is a strong lady. Wow, she got through that. I don't know if I can do that. And I'm not sure.
But they can. But they can. Because the one thing that I had to do, not just for me, but for my children, because if I'm a mess, then my children are a mess. That's how that works. Children look to the stronger parent for guidance. They look to them to find out how they should react or act towards a particular situation. My children were looking to me every time they showed something on TV, every time their dad was mentioned, they looked right at me in my face, and I made sure that I had a pleasant look on my face, that I had a smile on my face, because, as I stated, regardless of what anybody else says, he is their dad. And I told them that I am not going to say anything bad about your dad. I'm not going to do that. And my son looks just like him, laughs, talks, walks just like him. And the only thing that I say to him is, you know what, you look just like your dad, and we smile about it. Because they didn't have a choice, rather, how they would come here. That was between God, and he brought the both of us together to bring them through. In order for me to get through what I went through, I got a dictionary. And I looked up every emotion that I was experiencing, from guilt, shame, hurt, pain, because pain before trauma has a different meaning after trauma. So you have to look up your emotions, find the definition that resonates with your spirit, and deal with it. Don't overlook it. If you feel like crying, then you cry, because every teardrop is one step closer to your healing. If you're hindering your crying, you're hindering your growth. They go one in one, synonymous together. And that's the same thing I told my children. My children will tell you right now, I am entitled to my feelings. No one has a right to take my feelings from me. If I want to feel sad, I have a right to feel sad. If I want to be angry, I have a right to be angry. And I have a right to express it in a manner that is respectful, but I can express how I feel. And that's what I taught them to do. So we would talk about this all the time. They want to talk about their dad? Let's go. Mom, what do you think? I need to understand how you're feeling. I need to understand where that's coming from, because we need to get to the root of that emotion. We can dig it up, deal with it, and move on from it. And one thing I told them, that you will not be able to use your dad as an for failure. You're not going to come to me and say, my dad was the DC sniper, so I can't move forward, or I'm having emotional problems. Wrong answer. Not going to work. We're going to work through it. We're going to get over it, and we're going to keep moving. That's what I told them. And anybody who's listening, who's a victim of domestic violence or a survivor, you're trying to understand what it is that you're feeling, then you have to get it out of your head, for one thing, and put it on paper. We are a visual people. If I don't see your pain, then your pain does not exist. If you don't get that pain out of your head and put it on paper, then you're not able to deal with it, because you don't see it. As soon as you see it, you can understand it, you can deal with it, and you can move on from it. That's how I did. That's what we had to do, because I was not going to go throughout my life with 2 bags with John's name on it. Not happening, and neither were my children. So that's how we got through it. And that's how they get through their situations on their own as young adults. Something comes up, they know what to do. They know how to handle it.
I applaud you. I applaud you. I mean, this is something, because a lot of people don't feel what you feel. They don't understand. They just think they have to lay there and take it. You know, like that movie, The Burning Bed, and that woman got up out of there and she said, no, this is not happening. The same thing. And when it comes to your children, I understand. And I know there's a whole lot of people out there who are not even mothers, but aunties and uncles and granddaddies of your own. They're not, but to hear you speak, how dynamic that force was within you to say that, no, I'm not letting this happen. But at the same time, you're going to respect the person who helped bring you here, your father.
Right.
You're going to respect him. He had
We're not
illness.
Going to take responsibility for his actions.
Right.
We're not going to do that. He did what he did on his own, in his right mind. So that's not our responsibility to take. And we're not going to.
That's right.
And we're not going to be held accountable for his actions. Most times people think or feel that when you're married to somebody, then you're responsible for them. He's an adult. He's responsible and should be held accountable for his own actions. That's not my responsibility. I'm his ex-wife. I was his wife, and I'm not his mother. So, and so that is where that comes from. We're all accountable for our own actions.
Yes.
Victims should not be blamed for what an abuser does. But what did you do to make him do that? He made a decision on his own to hit me. He made a decision on his own to keep money from me. He had made a decision on his own to show his coworkers he's a good person and come home and beat me or take advantage or hurt our children. These are choices that they make. They have anger management classes for what? You don't get angry with your boss. You don't get angry with your friends. You don't get angry with the people you worship with. But when you come home, you get angry with me. That's a choice. That's a choice.
Mm-hmm. You know, that is a choice. But then you think about it. Why couldn't he get angry with his peers or his boss or so out there and comes home? Because to me, that person is a wimp. You have to come back to me to show your command and your control, you know, and you're not dealing with it out there where it needs to be handled. It's not
right.
necessarily violent, but to taking care of situation, and you're going to bring it in the house. You know, that's where it becomes,
right.
that's where it gets in the way. You know, and there's so
and that's
many
why
people
they call it
there.
A Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yes, yes. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So folks out there who are listening and they're in the seat of being the abuser, are you a Dr. Jekyll or are you a Mr. Hyde? You know, who are you? That's something that we have to examine in our lives. Who are we? What are the things that we like? What are our thoughts about? You know, where is it taking us when it comes to working with other people, whether there are people in the home or there are people out there that we encounter that are outside of the home? Even for the ministers who are online, and Pastor Thicklin and I have gone and talked in faith symposiums about counseling in the churches, in the synagogues, in the mosque, and so forth, counseling, talking to others, not to be afraid of speaking the fact. And speaking the fact that people are responsible for themselves. And our responsibility in the ministry is to assure that they folks take recognition to that. You know?
And Dr. Douglas, one other important point, Dr. Douglas, is that Mrs. Muhammad was talking about the physical violence, but the mental abuse is also a large part of that scenario. And sometimes it may be mental abuse as opposed to physical abuse. And either way, that's an unacceptable situation to be in. And I guess as folks are listening, they need to understand that as soon as you start to see those signs, you have to get the assistance that you need, whether it's from law enforcement, whether it's from counseling. Oftentimes, in these situations that I've seen over the years, sometimes, and I'm not referring to Mrs. Muhammad's particular case, but just some of the victims that I've seen over the years felt that, well, as time progresses, maybe things will change, he will change, or she will change, and that, you know, this is just one of those, we're just, this is the, what do you call it, the better, for better or for worse moments. And as we see now, that it's very important to get the assistance that you need to make sure the entire family receives that assistance. And that you deal with these issues as honestly and as candidly as you can under the circumstances. And that is certainly easier said than done, because when you're in the heat of that moment, oftentimes you don't think of these things. But and that's why it's so important that there are support mechanisms available to remind anyone that may be in that situation of what is available to assist them in those situations.
You know, one of the things that is so important, and I do hope tonight, even for those that are listening, and Fatima, I know that you're there. Please just let us know if there are any callers out there that desire to come on and may have a question. Since you have full control of the board there, just make us aware. But one of the things I want to interject that I think is so, you know, that is so evident is the fact that, you know, it's almost against human nature to suspect that someone that you love would actually harm you or hurt you. So I think the first sense of rationale for most people is to think whether or not this is just a one-time thing. Perhaps this isn't going to be, and we try to rationalize through things inside of that. But I think one of the key things to understand that it, you know, domestic violence and abuse is a pattern of behavior. And if we continue to see patterns and we see these things happening, we have to make a decision inside of that. And that decision is to protect ourselves, is to protect our lives and our livelihood. Oftentimes the perpetrator, the abuser, whether they are cognizant of all the things they're doing or in denial or accepting of it, as Mildred said, they're going to have to take responsibility for those actions themselves. They're going to have to do so. And one of the things I've discovered is that so many times it's not even a matter. It's not even a matter of what happened. You know, it's not even a matter of that individual, you know, basically acknowledging what they've done. It's a matter of that person understanding that they can get what they want in doing what they do. And so they continue to do it until something happens or someone gets out or someone gets hurt, and that tend to be the line of thought that goes inside of it. But for every person that is being victimized, have been victimized, it is so important for them to recognize the fact, the danger that they're in, and to recognize the fact that you don't have to eat a whole cow to know that it's beef. If you're seeing the patterns, if you're seeing the behaviors, you know, you have to start thinking about yourself and how you can access resources to get out of that.
That's a good point. Well, how can you access those resources, and where are those resources?
The Internet is a wonderful thing these days, mm-hmm. Because you can Google domesticshelters.org. And that gives you a list of all of the resources that are available in every state. Also, 80% of victims don't have physical scars to prove that they are victims. John didn't hit me at all, not one time. But the verbal assault and the emotional, economic abuse that he put me through made me feel bad. But because I didn't have scars to prove I was a victim, I couldn't get the resources, because in some states, if you don't have physical scars, then you are not able to get compensation or any type of resources. And it's difficult to know which states those are until you start to look them up. And then some states, they've taken the advocates out of the court that would help you to get a restraining order, and now you have to learn the terminology for yourself in order to get the restraining order that you need. It's important that we all try to help each other in this process when someone comes to you for help. You may not know what to do, or you may know someone who's being victimized and unsure of how you can help. So I would say, don't play the hero. don't go in there thinking you're going to be the savior to this person. Ask one question, and that is, how can I help you? Wait for the person to respond, because you may be the only one who has taken the time to ask, how can I help you, instead of telling them what to do, because at that point, then you begin to sound like the abuser. Don't, if it gets to the point, then call the police. They're trained in these types of situations. They're the first responders. And if it gets really bad, then call the paramedics so that they can come and get the help that they need. But we all have to do diligence in helping each other. We can't keep walking away or turning a blind eye because we don't see someone being abused or don't recognize it to be abuse. And sometimes we don't. Sometimes the person that we're looking for, the person who's abusing us, we remember them when we first met, how that relationship was. And once the abuse starts, we keep looking for the same person that we met in the beginning instead of looking at the person that we're dealing with right now. They are the same person physically, but the person you met in the beginning was the representative. It takes 90 days for you to become emotionally attached to someone. And after those 90 days, that's when the real person comes out. Then you're stuck, or you feel like you're stuck because you've told everybody how wonderful this person is. But you should always tell someone. That's how you break the silence. Tell someone. Ask them, what can you do? Look at them, look it up on the internet for help. You don't have to stay, but you need to plan. I never tell a victim to leave, but I will tell you to plan, because in your planning, you will know when it is the safest time to leave, especially with 75% of victims who try to leave an abusive relationship are killed.
And also, some of the folks that don't necessarily have access to the internet, a large majority of police departments and prosecutors' offices also offer information and assistance for individuals that may be undergoing these types of incidents. So, and they often will refer you to various other agencies and resources that may assist as well. And of course, as Mrs. Muhammad said, the police certainly stand ready to intervene if that is appropriate, but they do have other resources available for people.
Wow. I'm educated, but I'm still learning, and I'm hearing this subject tonight. I'm hearing what's being brought before us, and I'm still learning. And I'm feeling good about it. You know, I'm feeling really good about it, because as I learn, as you learn, then you carry it forward and you pass it on and you teach others. I want to direct you before I forget to look at the Mildred Muhammad story, Scared Silent. And she writes, when the one you love becomes the one you fear. At first I looked at Amazon and I read the little sample there. And I couldn't get enough. So I ordered the book from Amazon. And I'm going to get a used book, right? So I'm glad I did. In the book, on September 30th, in the year 2014, Ms. Muhammad, you signed this book. And you signed it for a lady by the name of Luz, L-U-Z. And you wrote in there, thank you for your support. So I'm really happy to have a book that came from someone where you had signed it, and I'm going to pass it on. So some of my church members are online. You'll see it in our church library, and know that you please read it. Please read it. And for Chief Michael Blow, I'm happy that here in Palm Beach County, we have a domestic violence unit here in our police department. And he works very closely with us. We have an attorney in our church who is a member of the domestic violence unit and is also the board of directors president of the YWCA.
She's the chief attorney over the domestic violence unit in Palm Beach County.
Yes, right, for the Department of Justice. And I'm happy to say that for all that you know, with this subject, and my granddaughter was trying to decide which way she should go. She decided to get her doctorate, and she's counseling domestic violence at the YWCA. So there are so many others. There are so many. Pass it on. Bridge yourselves. Become educated. Become, like my dad used to use the word, learn it. You know, get to it, you know, to understand what this is all about, because the children carry it when they go to school and they begin bullying others. You know, they carry it. You know, so try to help the society. Yes, I'm happy that domestic violence has become a crime, a felony, where people can be charged with as a felony. Yes, I'm happy to see that. But there's no reason. God says to love one another, not to beat one another down. You know, and like you said, it's there are some states that don't recognize that they don't see the bruises. So what are you talking about? Or want to blame you? Well, what did you do? You know, blame the victim. No, stop blaming the victim. And in all rights, do you know that the abuser is also a victim? Because the abuser picked it up. He wasn't born with that. You know, he made a choice to live that way. That was a part of his security, his blanket, you know. And recognizing domestic violence in your home. Yesterday, I was in a medical unit, and we were talking about domestic violence. There was a young lady who said, I never heard of it. I don't know anybody that went through it. But I realized that she didn't recognize the meaning of it, you know. So that's important. When somebody treats you roughly, when you feel that people want to blame you about how they feel, or they want to isolate you from your family and your friends, and do you make excuses to other people? Do you feel that no matter what, it's up to you to try to please that individual, even though they're harming you? That's domestic violence. Not necessarily all the punching and the cussing. It could be the way you're being treated as human beings by your partner.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have about 6 minutes left, and I definitely want to. There are plenty of callers that are out there. So if you're there tonight and you want to get a question in or comment in the last 6 minutes that we have left, hit the number 1 on your keypad. That lets the engineer know that you want to get on the air. And she's ready to take your call. So if you hit the number 1 there and you've done so, please come on the line. I can't give you the last 4 digits of your number because I'm not in the direct studio. But if you hit the number 1, we welcome your question and a comment right now.
So we have these few minutes. Chief Blow, do you have any passing thoughts you want to give us before we go offline?
Well, I just think that the issues surrounding domestic violence, and we've seen one example of the impact it had not only on Mrs. Muhammad and her children, but how it impacted the region. And I'm just so happy to see now that over the years, law enforcement, prosecutors' offices, and other agencies clearly understand that, you know, that things that go on behind closed doors are other people's business, and that we do need to intervene as appropriate, because it not only is a horrible thing for the family, but as Dr. Douglas said, when you have young people that see this every day, then they now think that this is the way that I have been taught to deal with my spouse or my friends when I don't agree, or I've had a bad day, or something else is bothering me, and it just perpetuates itself over and over and over again. And so I'm just very glad to see now that there are laws out here that are very stringent about prosecuting domestic violence suspects. There are various types of programs to assist family members and others who have been exposed to this type of unacceptable behavior. And I just hope that next year at this time, you know, that we don't even have to have this radio program, because there's been such an impact in these types of incidents that we can move on to some other things.
Yes. So, okay. Ms. Muhammad, do you have some last words you'd like to give us tonight?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for having me on the show, and it was a pleasure meeting Sheriff Blow. I hadn't talked to
yes,
him
ma'am,
or heard him speak before. So I just
want to
say. And
it was my pleasure as well.
Oh, yes, sir. I just want to say that to victims and survivors of domestic violence, you are entitled to how you feel. Don't allow anyone to tell you that you need to get over it or get on with it. Seek the help that you need in order to understand who you are. And it's important that you love yourself more than you love your abuser, because that's the first step in coming up out of feeling that you're not worth anything.
Absolutely. Well, that is such good advice tonight, and it's been an absolutely pleasure and honor to have both of you here, and it's just so interesting that, you know, that the incidents of the past caused your roads to intersect at a time that was very challenging for not only you individually, but as a nation it was, community and society. Yet today you're able to be on the side of it, that you continue to be a voice of reason, a voice of hope, a voice of inspiration, and a voice that will be a great encourager to those who may be suffering at the hands of violence today. So, once again, we commend you both.
You know,
this month is
Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Every month, please look at it as Domestic Violence Awareness. This month, we're wearing the purple color, the color of purple. As you know, our scandal star, Kerry Washington, has started something called the Purple Bag, and people are contributing towards that to help victims and also abusers to get help. So I have on my purple nail polish. Everybody stops me in the street and say, wow, purple nail polish, that gives me an opportunity to talk about domestic violence and make them aware of it. So listeners, you know, don't forget your purple for the month. Talk about it. Embrace the subject to put the word out there to let folks know that they are not standing alone, that they are not by themselves. Bring the subject to a point and let's educate each other and one another. So I'd like to say to everyone, I'd like to say goodnight, but I'll let Pastor J.R. Fickman close us out. Jay, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm so sorry. I think my line was on mute. Nevertheless, thank you so very much once again to each of you that have tuned in tonight here to IDVAC Blog Talk Radio. And as always, you can always find IDVAC Blog Talk Radio every Thursday night, 8 o'clock on the Eastern Time Zone, 7 in the Central, 6 in the Pacific, 6 in the Mountain, and 5 in the Pacific. Wherever you may be, you'll find IDVAC Blog Talk Radio. Until next time, listen, be strong, be safe, and remember, there is no excuse for domestic violence. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today's show. You've been listening.